KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today we revisit a topic that we've discussed on occasion on Hearsay Culture, but we're going to discuss it in depth today. The topic is search engines, and the author is Professor Alex Halavay of Quinnipiac University, author of the recent book Search Engine Society, part of the Digital Media and Society series published by Polity. Search engines, of course, are, for most internet users, the gateway to accessing any information on the internet. We question whether we even need the browser's address bar, where you used to type in an address, because so many people use search engines as a way to get to that information. But search engines, of course, because they are that gateway, have a lot of power. And that power comes down to the power to rank, and to rank information and order information in a way that ultimately leads potentially all users of the internet towards certain links, certain sources of information, and not others. Consider how many times you click past the 10th or even 20th result in a Google search. Search Engine Society breaks down the very difficult issues from a regulatory perspective as well as a social policy perspective in how search engines have impacted our use of knowledge, our use of information, and how we operate on the internet. And Alex Halavay's book is an excellent overview as well as a detailed study of the policy issues that we face in what he terms a search engine society. The topics of his book speak for themselves: searching, attention, knowledge and democracy, censorship, privacy, sociable search, and future finding. Of course, as always on Hearsay Culture, we can only touch the tip of the iceberg in our discussions, but we will get into some of these issues in a bit more detail throughout our discussion. I think Alex's book, and importantly, Alex's book, has a certain view, which I think, which is a view that to which I am sympathetic, but we're going to discuss in more detail, which is simply that we need to know more about how search engines operate. And indeed, Alex writes in his introduction, those who recognize their power, that is, the search engine, those who recognize their power and are able to exercise control over it will help to shape our collective future. Now, we think of search engines in the context of Google, and right now, of course, Google is in a very public and very closely followed settlement negotiation with a variety of authors, including the Authors Guild, regarding one of their more ambitious, perhaps most ambitious project, although we could debate that as well, since search engines are pretty ambitious in and of themselves. But the Google Books search issue is front and center. And so, of course, when we think about search engines, we think about Google. But it is important to think about search engines beyond the paradigm of merely Google, because search itself is a property of the internet that many other entities can be involved with. And you can think of search as something as simple as a search of your own website and a rather primitive search engine you might have, to the broadest search engines that Google represents. So we have a lot to cover today on Hearsay Culture. I'm very excited and fortunate to have on Professor Alex Halavay discussing his book Search Engine Society. We are recording this show on the day that it will air, so we have a good timing here. Alex, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, my pleasure.
Alex, I always ask my authors, and I think a good way to start off is for you to discuss a bit more of your background beyond your position and how you got interested in writing a book about search engines.
Sure. So when I was in graduate school, actually, we'll go back into the ancient history. When I was an undergrad, I became interested in kind of the intersection between computing and politics and computing and social interaction. I happened to be at a good place to do that, UC Irvine, during the early 90s, when people weren't really thinking so much about how the internet might have a larger social effect. By the time I got to graduate school, I was looking at the structure of the web, because the web was kind of the clear winning application of the internet, and I was interested in what made the web different than other ways of distributing information or publishing information, and it was clearly that hyperlinked nature. And at the time, You know, at your introduction, you noted that the search engine is the gateway of the web, but we still really did talk about surfing the web. It was something that was based very heavily on following hyperlinks. It still is to a certain degree, but I think search engines have largely usurped that process. And so I was looking at kind of what the major movers were or how it was that things got organized and people arrived where they wanted to arrive. And I was particularly interested in sites like Flashdot and other sites that focused public attention on a particular issue or on a particular website or application. And I continue to do that, and I continue to do that today, but in the background, in part because it was so important, were search engines, and I hadn't touched it because it just seemed like it was part of the everyday experience of the web, and it turns out that lots of people weren't thinking about just how important search engines were. And so now we have lots of books coming out about search engines in various forms, but what got me interested in thinking more deeply about the social implications of search engines was, in large part, that so few people were thinking about it. They were using it without really thinking about it.
You know, one of the things, and I teach cyber law at Elon, and it is not self-evident, I think, to even people that think about technology, that there would be an actual discipline or focus area on search. And we talk about, at least in a law perspective, the law of search. You know, I'm curious from your background, because you're not a lawyer, and rather you're a professor of communications. Within the communications and media studies field, has search as a discipline or as a scholarly area taken on a life of its own, or is it still part of the larger general discussion of communication that we see?
No, I think it's. I think there's a nascent interest in it, but I don't think that it has. That it has taken off in the same way it has in other places. I mean, there is an increasing combination of information sciences and library sciences and their effect on communication. And so you see schools that are combining those two fields. And so you do have some influence there, but at least for now, I don't think we're handling search as a separate or even a sub-discipline. I don't think it's received that kind of attention yet.
Should it?
I think absolutely it should, and I should say, as I did, it is a nascent area, and so I think you know there are a number of scholars that are interdisciplinary and crossing those boundaries and are starting to think about it more deeply. I think absolutely it should. I think some of this is a legacy of thinking about mass media, and so you do have studies of attention of mass media. Traditionally, there's an area that's called agenda setting that looks at how people come to think certain issues are important. And priming and some other kind of issues of how journalists can shape the media agenda. And so there is an entree into the question of search engines there, but traditionally, you know, it hasn't been such a fraught or such a complicated issue of how people come to attend to a particular message. I think that's changing, and I think with interactive media in general, people are thinking a lot more about journalists especially, about why people look at things and how they get there.
You know, you title your book Search Engine Society, and I think I want to focus on the word society, because is there an implication in your title or in the focus of your book that the issues involving search that you discuss are broader than merely the operations of the Internet, or am I reading too much into the title?
No, I think you're absolutely right to read that as broadly as you possibly can. It turns out that it's very difficult to talk about search at all without talking a lot about Google. But you know, that was actually one of the more difficult things to do in the book, is not make it a book about Google. And then to talk more broadly about search engines, I actually wanted to go much further afield than that and talk about kind of what it means to find things both on the Internet and off the Internet. I think it's right to read it that broadly. I mean, we threw around a lot of names, search engines and society, or you know, search engine society implies that society is changing to become more search-focused, and I do think, although I don't make a strong argument for that, I think in the book, I do think that that is the case, that the way we think, the way we organize our institutions is becoming much more search-centric.
The focus of the book is search, and one of the things that you start the book off with, and this gets us into a more general discussion of your focus and perhaps a thesis, but in the interest of transparency, you point out a particular bias that you have that you want to reveal to the reader up front. What is that bias, and how is it relevant to one's reading of your work?
Oh, that's a really good question, because I'm not sure. I'm trying to think back to what bias I revealed. I have lots of biases. My guess is that the tendency is towards extraordinary transparency.
Yes,
that,
correct.
My push is to make the argument that that we need to be as open as possible. And so given that my background is looking at ways in which messages tend to get buried, I suspect that that's the bias I'm coming in. How am I
yeah.
doing?
No, one of the limitations of the phone, yes, you have nailed it. You point out in your introduction that you, and this is quoting you to you, people use search engines, and that is slowly approaching everyone, should know how they work and what they mean to society. So you go on to say the appropriate search engine does not promote authoritarian dominion over knowledge, but invites communal finding and search sociability. And you context that as a bias that runs throughout the book.
Yep. So that at least I know my own bias.
Yes.
I think part of the reason I wanted to write the book is I think that search engines do tend to be an important and increasingly the important institution or technology, however we want to refer to it, in which power is reproduced, that is, in which existing structures of power are represented and maybe continued. So it's a very conservative force in that respect. And so I think it's important that people understand how search engines work, not because in some general sense, I think it's good that people are technically literate, although I do, but in particular because I think they have such an important influence on the structure of knowledge in society. And so because of that, and because I think that everyone should be able to contribute equally to that structure, I think it's important that they understand the forces shaping that structure.
We're talking with Professor Alex Halavay, author of the book Search Engine Society on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Alex, let's talk a little bit more in a little bit more detail about your book by focusing on, again, this is a fairly broad question, but is, and perhaps you've said it already, is there a core thesis or point that you want to make in writing the book? Now, perhaps it is that point that simply that we need to understand more about how search engines operate. But is there any other overarching theme that you weave throughout the book, or any goal?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it, and it seems like a very basic idea. But that's the idea of any book, right? I want to convince you that this is something important to know about, and then I want to tell you about it. But in this particular case, I think that there is the assumption that that maybe search engines are too technical, or that it's a very technical subject and therefore not of interest to the general user, or I understand search engines because I use them every day. I mean, those are all kind of common understandings of what it is. And I wanted to make sure that people understood there was a problem in that, that they don't have to understand necessarily the nuts and bolts of what makes a search engine work, but they have to understand the decisions that go into that. And so a lot of this is saying, okay, when we look at the search engine, it tells us a lot about our decisions, not just about search engines, but about what we think is important in society, about what we think is important about who communicates to whom and who controls that communication. So that it ends up being a kind of window on some pretty important questions that we ask ourselves and that get answered, and that sometimes get answered without a lot of public discussion or thought.
You pointed out something earlier that I think helps contextualize the discussion as well, which is the effort to write a book about search engines without heavily focusing on Google. A, how do you do it? And B, pushing back, isn't Google, because it's such a dominant force, the crucible through which we should do this analysis? In other words, why avoid writing a book about Google?
Yeah, I don't know that I wanted to avoid writing a book about Google, but again, this is one of those questions of if Google is the dominant force and I'm writing a book about the possibility of alternatives and the possibility of other ways of thinking about distributing information in particular, then I think I wanted to avoid the trap of it being all about Google. That said, I mentioned Google far more often than any other search engine, just as many users use Google far more often than any other search engine. I think it's important that we look at alternatives for a bunch of reasons. One of those reasons is I don't think that leaving aside whether Google as a company will continue to be dominant, I don't think that the present-day Google search engine will continue to be dominant indefinitely. And so one of the reasons to look at alternatives is because they may represent what search looks like in 5 years or 10 years or even today, given that there's how fast things move. A lot of the things I talk about as being in the near future in the book are in the very near present. So that's one reason to look forward. The other is, again, that you want to kind of look at different levels. While Google may be the dominant general search engine, there are other searching technologies that operate in different contexts.
The issue of search engines, of course, belies a basic question, which is how they work. And I found, at least in my discussions, that most people, even if they use them, have very little idea, if any, on how the results actually come up. So for those listeners that aren't familiar, perhaps you could give a brief overview of the basic nuts and bolts of how a search engine delivers your search results.
Sure. So, I mean, at a very basic level, we can split it into two pieces, and one is maybe more straightforward, and one is where some more complexity becomes involved. At a very straightforward level, a search engine is just a kind of index. So when you enter in a key phrase into Google and it comes back and says, I've found the answers in however many microseconds or milliseconds, it isn't going out and traversing the web at that moment trying to find the information you're looking for. It generates an index by constantly going from site to site and looking and pulling in the data from that site and generating an index. As an index, it's not that different from, say, the index in a book, or for those of us who are old enough to remember these now, a card catalog in a library. Mm-hmm. So it's basically a extracting the information from the page itself and providing an index to make sense of that page. Where things get a little bit more complicated is if you're searching for a particular word, if you're searching for example for Stanford University, and you enter that search into Google, the return is not going to be a few things, but many thousand things. This is something that was not necessarily a problem with the card catalog. Even if you had millions of items in a library, you were at most going to end up with a few dozen items when you went through a card catalog and searched. And so where things get more complicated and perhaps more controversial is what items get to be ranked first or what items you see first when you make that search. Since very few of us go beyond the first page of searches, in fact, very few of us look beyond the first two or three items that are presented as search results, the ways in which those items are presented, the order in which they are presented, becomes especially important.
The part of the introduction of your book implores users to exercise power over a search engine. What does that mean exactly? How does one exercise power over a search engine, and what do you mean by exercise power?
Unfortunately, for the most part, our sole way of exercising power over a search engine today is to choose another search engine. That is, it's a little bit like exercising power over our television schedule. You can change the channel. That said, I think there are ways in which people can look and understand how search engines work and make determinations based on those understandings. I suspect that the next form of search, and we're already beginning to see this, is social search. That is, search engines that are based much more heavily on groups of users and how other people have assembled their data and made sense of their data. And Google, and among others, are beginning to make heavy use of social networks to determine what items should be displayed first to a user. So some of that is already happening kind of, again, outside of the view of the common user. I think that the first step is for users to understand what's going on, and then once they understand how search is working and how different search engines behave differently, they're able to take steps in choosing where they decide to search and how they decide to search.
The three questions that you identify in the book are interesting, and you talk about how we can think about and ask questions about search. So how would you define those three questions?
See, now I'm being tested on my own book as well, and I'm not sure that I have the three questions straight up.
That's so, fine. No, I can.
In particular,
I can break it down in more detail. You think about in the book, you talk about how people enter items into a search engine and how they interpret the results. And so this is the interface question, which I think a lot of people kind of wonder about. When we think about the interaction, the human interaction between the user and the engine itself, what is the relevance of the interpretive factor? In other words, why do we need to know more about that idea to understand the impact of search engines?
Right. So, I mean, at a very basic level, we often think about, I mean, people actually look for the search box. They've Google was a big piece of this when they designed a search engine, first of all, that had a very back-end, a technical component that was very successful compared to other search engines, but also their visual display was simply a box, and it said, you know, type in what you think is appropriate here. And this was a huge shift in the way people interacted with search engines. Many of us have gone through, if you've been through a university program where you were instructed on how to enter terms into a library search form and the Boolean logic behind that. And Google kind of said, let's just hear your thoughts in a very general sense. And so the way we get the information into the search engine has changed, and I think that's become the dominant way, that we expect to see a box where we can just kind of type in whatever is at the tip of our mind. And we can talk about this if you like. There's a little piece here of some of us are much better at doing that, of thinking in terms of what we expect will work well for the search engine and developing that kind of top-of-mind indexing in our own brain to match up with Google's brain. And then we have a certain kind of way of interpreting those results as they come back. And so, again, Google, as our dominant model, comes back with a 10-item list, and we scan that in particular ways. And how we make sense of what comes back and the simplicity or complexity of that model is important. So Google has gone to a very basic model intentionally, and there is an alternative. You know, it's kind of the question between playing an MP3 player where you push a button and you get music out, and playing a piano where you have to push lots of buttons and get very complicated results back. And an interface that allows you to do both is in some ways the ideal. But in order to reach a popular audience, the first model, a very simple model, is often the dominant model.
Yeah, and you discuss in the book, related to that, you discuss in the book the history of search and how search engines developed, and I think you implied it here, but I'll ask it directly. I mean, is it your opinion or your sense, or perhaps, you know, factually, that search engine designers consciously design the interface to achieve the goal that you mentioned? In other words, it isn't a matter of happenstance that this, in fact, occurred this way. Are the designers of search engines, as much as you might be aware, actually consciously thinking about this interface in the context that you describe?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, and it's a complicated question, because if you ask a designer, they'll say, I'm designing to user needs, to these kind of ambiguous user needs. And in many cases, they're testing users. And in many cases, especially for the large search engines, they're constantly testing users. They're making use of analytics to see how people are using that interface in order to kind of meet those needs. But what that means is that you are looking for the result that matches most people most of the time. That is, that works for the largest group of people as frequently as possible. And that means designing an interface that hides the guts. We don't want, you know, expensive chronographs let you flip them over and see the gears running, and search engines explicitly do not do that. They give you as clean a display as possible and kind of hide some of the dirty details, the sausage making.
We're talking with Professor Alex Halavay, author of the book Search Engine Society, on KZSU FM Stanford's Hearsay Culture. That background information that allows a search engine to operate is something we referred to earlier, and I think this is a good time to discuss it. Because as you mentioned, and as people that focus on this area know, the algorithms through which search engines do their calculations for ranking purposes are in fact secret, and in fact they generally operate under trade secret theory. Again, recognizing that you're not a lawyer, so I'm not asking you the law question, but really from a policy perspective, if there is in fact commercial value to keeping the algorithm secret, what is in your view the main countervailing argument to say that no, the search engine algorithm must be made public?
Yeah, it's hard for me to make the argument that it must be made public. So this is a paradox, right? I think that users should understand how search works, and at the same time, I'm not. I would have a hard time making the argument that search companies should be required by law to provide information about how their search is working. Part of the issue is, as you say, those algorithms are very central to their business model. That they are what makes it work. If I were talking to someone who is working at Google, they would tell you that by making them public, it works not as well. The reason for that is that there are people who are constantly trying to reverse engineer how the algorithm is working so that they can manipulate it. So one of the arguments against revealing the algorithm for whatever search engine, Google or another, is that by doing so, you provide the information that someone trying to manipulate those results, that is, companies that are often called search engine optimizers, either for good or for evil, are trying to make their results appear higher on the search results page. And so by revealing that, you diminish the efficacy of the search engine's ability to provide you with the best answers would be the argument, I think, from a designer's perspective. On the other hand, I think there is intention, this feeling that, at least in a broad sense, users need to understand how the search engine is working and how it's coming up with the results it is coming up with. And so, I mean, I can see, as from the user perspective, the ideal view of being able to look at something and next to the results that it's providing, actually provide you with some indication of why it's decided this is a more important result for you. Siva Vaidyanathan has talked about this a bit, that right now if you do the same search in different places and at different times, you get very different results without really an indication of why those results are different. And I think that, as a consumer of search results, is an important thing to get at.
We're talking with Professor Alex Halavay, author of the book Search Engine Society, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And you will get a very enthusiastic response from our underwriting department. Regardless, I do hope that you keep listening to KZSU, but I do hope that you seriously consider making a donation. Alex, I'm going to push back a little bit on the idea that the algorithm shouldn't be made public. And I think I want to push back in this direction by asking this question. If we call for and if we think that users should have power over a search engine, and if we're concerned about how users interact with the search engine itself, isn't it imperative for the efficacy of the engine itself that we understand how it works? And I think by doing that, I should be clear, when we're referring to the algorithm, we're literally referring to how Google ranks the results. And as I mentioned mentioned, and I think you'd agree, where the ranking falls and where your result falls in the ranking is important as to whether people will actually access your information. So isn't there an overarching concern that because search engines are this gateway and because we're concerned about how individuals interact with search engines, that there's an imperative for the efficacy of the engine itself, for how it operates, and perhaps that it is ultimately in Google's interest to reveal this information so that people understand how it works, which therefore makes the results more valid?
Yeah, and I think the key part of your question there is I think it's in Google's interest to do so. So let's imagine for the moment an open and public version of Google, a Google that didn't accept advertising, a Google that was operated as a public service, and that provided a clear indication of how it was coming up with search results. Would a user choose that? Of course, because they would have a better idea of what the results were, particularly if the results were equivalently useful. That is, the relevancy of what was coming back was roughly equivalent. I think they would choose the case in which they could understand why it was that a particular choice came up. Yes, I guess I'll agree with you in that regard. Again, the policy. I'm not a lawyer,
I'm not asking about the law.
I'm reluctant to say that we should require folks to reveal their algorithm from the political side. That is, that the state should do so.
Right.
But as users of these search engines, I think that as we learn more about them, we're going to make the choices for search engines that provide a clearer indication of what they're revealing to us and what they're not revealing to us. It's dangerous to make the case that we're not China. But in the Chinese context, if I'm someone searching Google in China, I want to know why it is that certain items are not showing up and what it is that is not showing up. And in that case, largely because of government censorship, there's no reason that shouldn't be the case here, that I want to know what's not showing up or what's being relegated to effectively being not showing up, which is, no one looks at the 100th page of a Google search. And so I want to know why they showed up, why they didn't show up higher on the list. As a user, I think that's important for me to know, and as a user, I think if I start to ask those questions, I might choose a search engine that provides a little bit more transparency.
The issue of transparency, of course, is, and again, to be clear, I don't intend to ask you about the law. I'm thinking about this more from a policy perspective and how we think about search. But one of the as you mentioned, one of the major issues that we're dealing with right now on an international scale is, in fact, this censorship. And to mention Google a moment, we know that Google has created search engines in countries like China that eliminate results with regard to things like Tiananmen Square. It's pretty fairly well known, and I imagine there are others other countries where Google may be inclined to do that. And yet, we also know Google's corporate aphorism of do no evil. But it seems like if search engines themselves are going to rely on phrases like do no evil as a way to mollify concerns that the rankings, in fact, are anything except honest, that they're going to have to do more to assure users that and give users confidence that the rankings are, in fact, an accurate representation of what one would want out of a search. So short of revealing the algorithm, are there other things that you think search engine companies generally should be doing that they are not to give consumers and users confidence in the results themselves, especially in the face of the admitted censorship that exists in certain jurisdictions?
Yeah, I think as a very starting point, a very low threshold starting point, that they need to be very explicit about the kinds of decisions that are going into the search process. And so, at a very basic level, I want a clear statement from a search engine that advertising or paid placement has no effect on the search results. I think that should be a fairly non-controversial request for most search engines. It seems to be in their best interest to reveal that. That is, that if someone pays for placement on what are often called the organic search results, that is, the search results that appear to be not paid for, that should be something that they should be explicit about if it's a paid placement process. Likewise, if a government or any other entity has delisted or requested that certain things not show up in the index, I think it is the search engine's responsibility to reveal that. And I think that's true of Google, who does not do that right now. And so you mentioned China, or there are other examples. For example, it's very difficult to search for anything having to do with Nazism in Germany and a number of other countries. And so I think it needs to be very clear when they've made changes to that list. I, for example, was blacklisted from Google for a short time because my blog was, not me personally, because there was spam. Someone had managed to put spam on my blog, and so, as it happened, there are ways to find that out, but it's not necessarily obvious to me as a publisher of that information why I've been blocked. And it's very easy to assume it's because Google doesn't like me in some way, because they haven't been explicit in some cases about it. And for the user, there's no way of knowing at all. They search and they wonder, why is it that my blog doesn't show up at all on Google? It does now, but when it was blacklisted, what is it that has led to its exile from the world's information, to use Google's own term? And so I think that kind of providing at the very bare minimum the policies by which people become excluded from the list and the policies that govern how the list is generated is useful. To bring it back to kind of a metaphor, I don't need to know the exact recipe of Coke to know its nutritional content. Mm-hmm. The state has expressed an interest in companies providing that nutritional content information to consumers. And so even if the state doesn't force them to do so, I think it's in the company's best interest to tell us a little bit about how search is arrived at and what we're getting for our search.
One of the other questions that you raise in the context of searching that we should ask is whether the mere existence of a search engine changes what people want to look for. And that's, I think, also a very interesting question. And last week on Hearsay Culture, Geert Lovink was on, and one of the things we talked about was the loss of serendipity and how we've lost the serendipitous nature of finding information, stumbling upon something in the context of structured search. But I want to get your view on that. I mean, how does, and I know you write about it, how does structured search impede serendipity?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that impede is probably the right word with regard to serendipity. It does something very strange to the way we think about our world and how we find things. Mm-hmm. I would argue that from talking, I teach at an institution where I teach graduate students and undergraduates, and if you talk to them, they'll talk about the Wikipedia hole. That is, some of them show up at Wikipedia looking for something and end up, 12 hours later finding something very different from what they started out with. And I don't think that the web as a whole feels that way anymore, in part because we don't surf from site to site. We tend to go in with an intention, and whether or not we end up with what we had expected, we at least have an intention going in and end up in some place. I think the problem is that the process of search I think it would be fair to say that in a given month I have one day at most in which I have not gone to a search engine and searched for something. That ubiquity of search makes us think about the world in searchable terms. When I get an email, because I use Google Mail, I don't think about sorting that email anywhere. I think about what the search terms I'll need to use later to find it are going to be. And so thinking about the world in terms of those search terms perhaps limits the way we find things accidentally. And so, it may be that serendipity is not completely removed, but that it has changed significantly. That we find new kinds of connections because of it. But more generally speaking, I am concerned that that at least the way search engines are structured now, we tend to limit our horizons and we have less of a view of the landscape of how knowledge is organized and what it's near to.
We are talking with Professor Alex Halavay, author of the book Search Engine Society on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Alex, one of the, in connection with this issue of serendipity is the idea that one may not ultimately know what they're looking for in the first instance. And in connection with search engines, getting back to how they operate, I wonder whether search engines attempt to play with that information, or that idea, I should say, of serendipity with the use of advertisements. Is it fair? Is it a fair analogy to say that the advertisements themselves can operate as a form of serendipity, considering the fact that we know that keywords are purchased by advertisers, so that if I do a search for, let's say, Mercedes, I can get an advertisement for Infiniti. Now, this is, of course, Infiniti car maker. Now, this, of course, is in the commercial context, and so I don't mean to propose that advertisements are the form of knowledge necessarily that we're most concerned about, but is there any fair analogy to be made in that direction?
I mean, it's an interesting point, and part of that is that advertising was probably more serendipitous as well. You know, if I pick up a copy of Wired magazine, I'm going to, in the process of paging through it, run into things that have nothing at all to do with my direct intent. And so advertising itself is becoming much more focused, that advertisers are for the first time thinking not about lifestyle choices or where they're going to reach their audience, but keywords, just like the rest of us. They start to think about, what are the keywords that I need to think about? It may be that advertising provides an interesting way of, again, disrupting our search process, but they're doing that in a very searchy way. They're doing that, again, by thinking about keywords and thinking about, even though it's not usually included in the organic search results, thinking about how to get their advertisement to show up at the most opportune time. This process of kind of search engine optimization now has to be done by advertisers, and I'm suspecting that more and more it's something that we'll all have to be doing, thinking about what keywords do we want to own, not where do we want to be, but what keywords do we want to be.
In the last 10 or so minutes that we have, I start getting into the questions that I term to be unfair. Unfair because we have a limited amount of time to get into them in sufficient detail. But nonetheless, we get into them. One of the other interesting areas that you talk about in the book is the impact of search on news reporting. From a broad perspective, how does a search engine impact the availability of news beyond the obvious point, which is, again, the fact that if I type in an event, I will get certain ranked results? But it goes much deeper than that, and what is that deeper point?
Yeah, I mean, and since the book has been written, and since the beginning of last week with Rupert Murdoch's announcement that he didn't want his news articles showing up on Google,
right,
this has become much more complex.
Right.
But in a very broad sense, what's the role of a newspaper or a news organization? It really is as a kind of as a curator, that is, surveilling the world and deciding what's most important about the events of the world and delivering those to an audience. In that regard, it's very similar to a search engine, actually. That's what a search engine does. It's a biasing engine. It takes the world of information and says, here are the things that I think are most important. And it says, here are the things I think are most important to you, getting a little bit of feedback from the user. Newspapers have generally said, here are the things that are fit to print. You know, here are the things that are important to you as an American. And search engines try to take that and say, here are the things that are most important to you as Alex Salovey searching for this particular term at this particular moment. And so it's a much more focused, much more narrow kind of search. And that's what they do to news. Newspapers are kind of being filtered through search engines. That is, there's a second step of flow. Newspapers take the first cut and say these are the most important things, and in many cases, search engines favor those most important things and say, okay, of those most important things that news organizations have already acted as a gatekeeper on and filtered in some way, here are the things that I think are most important to you as the individual user. So that's very much reshaping kind of what we see in the world and putting it through a lens that hopefully is reflective of our current interests and our current point of view.
And you mentioned, Alex, which is what I was going to go to next, and we're recording the show on November 20th, so it is particularly timely. But the statements by Murdoch with respect to delisting, I'm not aware of an entity as large as Fox ever asking to be delisted. What's your take on that request? And more specifically, how do you think the search engine should respond to it?
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting request, and whether it ends up being something that's actually acted on or merely a rhetorical exercise in order to focus attention on the relationship between search engines and news organizations. In either case, it's interesting. Now, if it were taken to the point of saying, okay, you don't have access to my materials, I think the broad response to that has been, well, that's ridiculous. In the new Web 2.0 world, you simply can't remove yourself from a search engine and expect people to be interested in you. I'm not entirely sure that's the case. I think that you might make a case for the possibility that people will go to a site simply because they're lost in the larger group of information, or you may be able to create enough of a fan community that you are able to bypass the search engine. But it does kind of bring into clear relief the idea that power has passed, and I think that's part of the response to this, that moment has passed in terms of filtering and gatekeeping from news organizations and the business models that drive them to search engines and the business models that drive them.
Can just playing this out a little bit more, and you make the fair point that this may not come to pass at all. But let's assume that the request is serious. Can an entity like Google, or indeed any search engine, delist a prominent news source, whether you agree with it or not, but a prominent news source, and still call itself a credible search engine?
Well, I mean, Google itself index is only a minority mm-hmm. of the web, mm-hmm. so Fox in the larger realm of things is a tiny minuscule speck mm-hmm. Of the total amount of information that Google is indexing. The question is whether it's a tiny but very important speck, and yes, I think that it can still maintain credibility. This is really the question, right? Is the reputational hit come? Does the reputational hit come to Google for not listing Fox, or to Fox for not being listed on Google?
Right.
And I think that page has already turned. I think that Google is more able to give reputation than dependent on Fox to receive that reputation at this point. So in the larger scheme of things, I think that Fox could do this, but by doing so, will marginalize themselves.
So you're not looking at this as the beginning of a trend of entities saying, hey, you know what, let's thumb our nose and delist at Google.
No, I think some of the discussion is whether this is a move in order to select another search engine. I mean, I would be shocked and extraordinarily surprised if Fox websites, even behind a paywall, no longer offered any kind of search. Mm-hmm. That it really is beyond the pale. We are programmed as human beings at this point to expect search on the web. And so there will be a search engine. These will be indexed in some way. What Murdoch is saying is that he wants to control the way that they're indexed in the machine that is indexing them. And you know, if you think about it from our discussion so far, some part of me says bully to him. He's taking control of his own search environment, and then bravo. I don't think he's perhaps doing it the right way, but there still will be search, and there's been some discussion of whether he expects that he then has something he can sell to another search engine, and this is sort of a power play in terms of shaping the search environment. But more generally, no, I think that he can exist, but only on the periphery if he does so.
We're talking with Professor Alex Halavay, author of the book Search Engine Society on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Alex, in a few minutes we have left, I'll ask two forward-thinking questions. So the first one is, and you mentioned earlier, but we can discuss a little more detail here, to the extent that there is a technology that will unseat Google as the predominant player, do you have any predictions as to what it might be, aside from the answer that you offer as the most obvious one in a book, which is no one?
Yeah, and I think that, at least in the short term, that remains the most obvious answer, that no one will usurp Google, and Google has done a good job in the intervening year or so since I finished the book of picking up a lot of the technologies that I suggest might be challenges and incorporating them.
Mm-hmm.
This was nothing particularly forward-thinking. Lots of people have been thinking about these technologies for a long time. But I think especially important in the short term are engines that are capable of very quickly coming up with what's important right now on the web. That is, not the web as kind of this deep archival item, but or piece of information, but, you know, what's on Twitter now. Twitter itself does a terrible job of indexing, you know, its own search engine does a terrible job of finding what's important on Twitter. And so the search engine that can effectively do that, and that may end up being Google again, is going to have a leg up. There's certainly issues of multimedia search where people can kind of find some ground for making important advancements. And so there's sites like TinEye that are trying to do graphical search and allow you to look for things that look like something. So there's space there. But I think the big one really is social search. That is, understanding that what I like is probably similar to what other people I know like. And so understanding that that my searches exist not just as an independent search, but as part of a history of my own searches, and probably as a history of searches of those whom I am closest to socially.
The last question I have for you, as far as the crystal ball view, of course, is this ongoing settlement negotiation in the Google book search area, which I think from a search perspective seems to be just another iteration of the basic questions that we've discussed heretofore, except now instead of indexing the web, Google is indexing printed books. Do you have a view or a perspective on how the settlement itself, or how more broadly Google should go about indexing books, assuming that they should do it at all?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does seem like a recapitulation in some ways of the larger question of search, right? But it does do some interesting things, because it's intersecting. One of the nice things about search from Google's perspective is that it was all virgin territory. And by interacting with this longer standing, I mean, publishing books has a much longer history than the internet as a whole does, and a much longer legal history, and a much longer history of findability. You know, with the web, their big push through was to make good use of hyperlinks as a way of finding things and ranking things. And right now, they haven't found the equivalent for books, and so really they're indexing in the same way others have. I'm concerned a bit because of that, that when I go to Google Book Search, it's not clear how things are being ranked or how something ends up at the top of that list. That's true of Google itself as well, but I'm particularly concerned because I really don't have any idea of how they're ranking things for Book Search. So because of that, if for no other reason, it would be really nice if there was something more public in terms of search, and particularly because there have been more public ways of searching books in the past, I would vote for a public option for book search.
Professor Alex Halavay, author of the book Search Engine Society, thank you for joining us on the show. And for those people who want to learn more about your work or perhaps upcoming projects, where can they find more information?
Google me.
Excellent. There we go. So the ringing endorsement of the dominant player in the search engine market. Alex, thank you for joining us today on the show. I enjoyed the discussion, and I invite you back down the road as we delve more. And when that new disruptive technology appears and unseats Google, you'll be the first person I reach out to comment on it.
I look forward to it. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited on the show today to have to be able to mention a number of guests that are coming up in the remaining shows on the, for this quarter. One new guest that, in light of what we just discussed with Alex Halavay, the Google Book Search, one of the areas I want to discuss in much more detail is, in fact, the settlement and its status. Professor James Grimmelman from New York Law School has really become through an amazing effort to blog, it seems like every step of the Google Book Search process over the last, you know, 2 years, let's say, has become one of the leading authorities in this area and has kindly and on rather short notice agreed to come on the show to discuss it in detail. So I'm excited to say that next week, James Grimmelman of New York Law School will be on the show discussing the details of Google Book Search and the revised settlement, which came out this past Friday. In addition, coming very soon this quarter, will be Kazis Varnelis from Columbia University, as well as Wendy Chun from Brown discussing her book dealing with identity and the Internet. Tarleton Gillespie will be on discussing his book involving copyright and content generally. And down the road, after the break on KZSU's schedule, which will occur during December, I'll be chatting with, among others, Professor Siva Vaidyanathan from the University of Virginia, discussing his book, The Googleization of Everything, Professors Frank Pasquale and Danielle Citron of Seton Hall University Law School and University of Maryland, respectively, discussing fusion centers. Bobby Qual of DePaul University discussing her book that's coming out on copyright as well. Laura Donardis from Yale's Information Society Project discussing her book on transparency and the operation and technology and the operation of government, as well as Subha Ghosh will be on discussing his work in intellectual property law generally. As always, you have a variety of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show live on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time in the Bay Area. You can also pick it up by streaming it at kzsulive.stanford.edu, or you can pick up the show by way of podcast through hearsayculture.com, where you can get all the previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. And you can also get the show through the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page by typing Center for Internet Society into the iTunes search engine. And lastly, you can also pick up the show by the RSS feed at Stanford's Center for Internet Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. And I thank you for listening today to Hearsay Culture. Please stay tuned to more diverse programming here on KZSU, and I will talk to you next week.